briefly now and again to ask a question or clarify a point. And when they had finished, he steepled his fingers under his nose and leaned back heavily.
"I was not here when the children were taken," he said slowly, "so I cannot speak to the exact circumstances of their abduction. When I returned, Peter was also gone, and those few dozen children who had not been taken filled in bits and pieces. But as children are wont to do, they did so imprecisely, so I can only speculate. As to the message Peter sent, I believe it was meant to tell Janie, yourselves, who it was who was taking the children."
"You know?" exclaimed John.
"I can guess," said Daedalus. "In your world, the crusade has begun. Might refer to any number of events. But here in the archipelago, particularly in the older parts, such as the Drowned Lands or the Underneath, the word crusade has only ever referred to one great journey, the original voyage of Jason and the Argonauts."
"How does that help us?" asked Jack. "Peter wasn't referring to that same crusade, was he?" Daedalus shook his head.
"Doubtful. Especially after what you found in the Library of Alexandria. No, I think he was referring to something entirely new."
The inventor thought for a minute more, then jumped from his chair and strode to one of the bookshelves set against the walls. He scanned the titles, then chose a large volume whose covers were of carved slate. The front was engraved with the Greek letter Alpha. Daedalus turned several of the pages, then looked up at the companions.
"Do any of you know the origin of the name Lost Boys?" he asked.
Bert frowned.
It's never come up. I always assumed it was simply a term of convenience, used for all the children in Barry's stories, based on the orphans Peter had taken in."
John shook his head. "It has to be far older than that. Kamenos Lieber, remember? Lost Boys? Perhaps the name came from the islands."
"No," said Daedalus. "The islands that guard the underneath were named because of who came here in the beginning, not the other way around. Jason was a great hero, in many ways the archetype for all who followed after. He had a remarkable charisma and a fierce intelligence, and he managed to draw together heroes with more power, authority, and experience than himself. He traversed the world on extraordinary quests, and saw his legend raised to immortality within his own lifetime. And that was his downfall. He let it go to his head. He saw himself as invulnerable, invincible. There was nothing that Jason could not do, especially with the support of his Argonauts, the demigod Heracles, the musician Orpheus, even the great Theseus himself among them. And when Jason had achieved his greatest victory and captured the Golden Fleece of Colchis, he destroyed it all by betraying his own wife, Medea, without whom he would have failed."
"Yes," said Jack, "after which, according to legend, she slew his sons in revenge."
"According to legend," said Daedalus, tapping the book, "but not according to history. True history, which spun out here in the underneath."
Daedalus handed the book to John.
"Can you read ancient Greek?"
he asked. "Well enough," answered John, taking the book, "as long as it isn't mixed up with Latin." He scanned the page the inventor had indicated, then the next, and the next. "Amazing," he muttered under his breath. He looked up at Daedalus. "I think I see what you mean."
"What is it, John?" said Jack.
"According to this book," explained John, "Medea never killed Jason's sons, but brought them to these islands in exile. They were left to fend for themselves, and became very bitter. They blamed their father for being abandoned here, so they discarded their Greek names and chose new names for themselves."
"What did they choose?"
asked Charles. "You'll never believe it," said John. "They called themselves Hugh the Iron and William the Pig."
"Those are the men in Bacon's history," Jack exclaimed. "The ones who stole the Red Dragon."
"To them, they weren't stealing," said Bert, "but reclaiming their birthright."
"Just so," said Daedalus. "The sons of Jason and Medea are the original lost boys.
That must be the right deduction, Bert said sadly. William and Hugh must be the ones who have taken the children and caused all the destruction.
They would have known the Red Dragon was once the Argo, reasoned Charles. And they did tell Bacon they were claiming their inheritance.
They also said to give a message to Peter and Jamie, said John. At least William did. So perhaps he believed that only they would be able to understand the clue and help. What can they possibly have been thinking? How could they be on a crusade of vengeance while at the same time be sabotaging their own efforts by trying to do the right thing?
That's adolescence for you, said Charles.
Satya Graha, John murmured. It's the basic conflict between the two halves of men's souls, said Jack. But Charles is right. There's no way to determine what they were planning.
You'd have to put yourselves in their sandals, said Daedalus. Imagine yourself to be them. Imagine you have been abandoned, and will never grow old, but you will never have anything more, because you are trapped, and all paths to the future are seemingly closed to you. What would you choose? How would you act if the means for retribution were placed within your grasp?
How can I make a determination like that, when I'll never be faced with the same circumstance? Said John. I have grown old. I have begun a family. I can guess what they have endured, but the recollections of my youth will be imperfect. So there's no way for me to know what I might have chosen when I'm already on a path I can't retrace.
Ah, said Daedalus. But what if you can?
Daedalus led the companions out of his workshop and down a cobbled path between the gabled towers to a brightly lit clearing where Sadie Pepperpot and Laura Glue had their garden. There were rows of carrots and lettuce, clumsily arranged between clusters of beets, corn, and some leafy vegetables that none of them could readily identify. Laura Glue was excitedly leading Avon around from cluster to cluster, and waved happily when she saw the companions approaching.
"Jack, Charles, John," she called, "you must see my snozzberries. They're almost ready to harvest."
"Snozzberries?"
Charles said behind his hand.
"Third dessert course," Daedalus replied.
"Ah, lovely," said Charles. "Show us the snozzberries, my dear girl."
"I'm sorry I left," said Avon. "I got caught up in a lot of old feelings. It's a very comforting place for me."
"No need to apologize," said Daedalus. "But you should come with us now. We're going to the well."
The inventor didn't explain, but walked past the gardens and into a small orchard that stood on a grassy knoll. The children followed, circling the grown-ups like a whirlwind of paper cranes, and took turns, interrupting one another in their haste to explain that the orchard was the reason Haven was built.
"This is Raleigh's orchard," said Laura Glue. "It was planted when the Indian colony first came here to the underneath." "But there was an argument with the people on some of the other islands," added Sadie Pepperpot.
"And so the Indians moved to the other island," said Fred the Goat, "and we've been at war with them ever since."
"The apples look very robust," Charles noted, tracing one of the heavy fruits with a finger. "Do you mind if we have a few?"
"The apples are for everyone," replied Laura Glue, "friend and enemy alike. But you must never, ever eat the seeds."
"What happens if you eat the seeds?" asked Jack. Pelvis Parsley pointed up at the tree directly adjacent to them, and the companions realized that the apple tree had a face. Looking more closely, they could make out the shape of a human torso and arms that had grown into branches, and it seemed as if the tree was observing them back.
"He's called Johnny Apple Tree," said Laura Glue. "A long time ago, he travelled across distant lands planting seeds, and apple orchards sprang up wherever he went. Then he got on a ship going to Angleland, but it never arrived. Instead, it came here, and he found out that apples are apples everywhere, but in the Netherland, you mustn't ever eat the seeds."
"If it's all the same," said Charles, "I think I'd like apples from a different tree. It feels a little too much like taking someone's ear to eat fruit from a tree with a name."
"Why was there war with the Indians over the orchard?" John asked. "Couldn't they plant trees of their own on Croatoan Island?"
"They didn't go to war over the apples," said Daedalus. "They went to war over echoes well.
The children led the companions down the hill from Johnny Appletree to a pile of stones that sat in a circle of grass. They gathered around the stones, which were stacked several feet above their heads, and John realized that the stones forming the base were not actually stacked, but rose up out of the earth itself. On one side was a broad opening, which dropped away into a deep hole. A well, John observed.
Echoes well, said Daedalus. Look into it, but do not speak.
Hesitantly, John leaned over the opening and peered down. There in the darkness, about a dozen feet below, a perfect reflection looked back at him. He leaned back and stepped aside so Jack and Charles could do the same, and he noted that Bert made no move toward the well at all, even for a peek.
It is an old magic, from a time when magic was new, science was old, and vanity was all, Daedalus said,
in a manner that was exceedingly reverent.
When the proper words are spoken into the well, it may allow you to become what you truly desire to be. If it is your wish to never age, you need merely speak into the well, and youth is restored. If it is your wish to become something other than what you believe yourself to be, then you may still get your wish, but may be no happier for it.
So, Daedalus concluded, this is your choice. To achieve your objectives at this critical time, to save those you have come here to save, you have to understand those who have come before. And to do that, you must become those whom you have been before. You must become boys who never grew up.
Does it really work? Jack asked.
Yes, said Avon, it does. I've done it myself.
Yes, you have, Poppy, Daedalus confirmed. Are you asking to do so once more?
Avon paused, then reluctantly shook her head.
I can't. I must admit I'm tempted, but I think when we find my son, it needs to be his mother he sees, not another child.
And you, far traveller? Daedalus said to Bert.
Surprisingly, Bert not only declined, but took a step backward, away from the well's opening.
I don't know, John replied, noting Bert's reaction. This has gone far afield of what I was willing to do.
But think, John, said Jack, understanding William and Hugh's choices, and how Peter interpreted their actions, may be the key to everything going on. How can we decline, if this is the only way?
I'll do it,
Charles declared to the other's surprise.
I don't think I'd mind spending a little time as a child again, just for the energy, mind you.
Bert shifted his eyes to look at Daedalus, but the latter took no notice. His attention was completely focused on the three young caretakers. Charles began to move closer, then halted. He took another step forward, and then two steps back.
I don't think I can do this after all, he said. To be completely forthright about it, I'm a bit worried that what I'll become isn't what any of us expect.
That's the talk of a lunatic, Jack exclaimed. You are who you are. What else could you be?
I'm not really an Oxford man,
Charles confessed. His level of distress at admitting this was evident by the nervous tapping of his fingers against his belt.
Not by any legitimate reckoning, that is.
Jack laughed.
That's nonsense, Charles. Of course you're an Oxford man. What are you playing at?
Charles let out a sigh and sat down on a stump a few paces away from the well.
I'm afraid all the play-acting was done before, and when I thought better of it, it was too late.
But when we met in London those years ago, you said you were from Oxford, protested John.
No,
Charles replied.
I said I was employed at the Oxford University Press, and that fool Inspector Close made the mistake of thinking that meant I was at Oxford University. And considering we were being questioned about a murder, I wasn't of a mind to correct him.
Actually, Charles continued ruefully,
I attended University College in London for a few years, and that's it, and that's all.
I've been to Oxford a number of times, certainly, enough to know the schools and the city. But a lot of common people, like the inspector, are oblivious to the difference between the press and the university, so I don't often clarify it for them.
But then, why not tell us afterward? Asked Jack.
Because the both of you were Oxford men, admitted Charles. And face it, Jack, I'm older than both of you, more so now than then, it seems. I'm a good writer, I think, but my true skills lie in editing and publishing, and I could tell very quickly the calibre of men you both promised to be, and I wanted you to respect me, Jack.
Charles, said John, I think you've already earned our respect a long time ago. Really, don't give it another thought.
There's just one thing, Charles added. Please don't tell Tumala.
Jack and John both grinned and clapped their friend on the back.
Don't worry, said Jack.
I don't believe Tumala will ever think any less of you, as long as you don't take up a post at Cambridge, that is.
So, said Dedalus, you have made your choice?
I'm afraid so, said Charles. It's just not for me.
The inventor turned to John.
And you, Caveo Principia, will you speak into echoes well?
John shook his head. One day, perhaps, I might feel the need to recapture my childhood. But today is not that day, thank you, no. Dedalus laughed.
The well does not steal the years from you. Can you ever recall a time when your faculties were not fully engaged, where every experience of your life did not form a chain with all of the rest? This is merely another link in the chain, but it is a link forged long ago, and it will shape your current perceptions accordingly. You will remain yourself, however you appear to us.
I'll do it. It was Jack who had spoken. It makes sense. I'm the least encumbered of any of us. I have neither a spouse nor children. If something goes awry, at worst I'll have to wait out a few years to retake the exams at Oxford. I can do this. Dedalus bowed and stepped back from the well. Jack stepped forward, then leaned in and looked down. There was no source of light in Echo's Well, but like the sky of the underneath, it glowed faintly with warmth. There was water not far below the rim, and Jack could see a reflection on the surface. It was his face, but it wasn't his reflection. It was an image he hadn't seen in decades. It was himself when he was a child. And so he said the only thing that made sense. "Hello, Jax. It's good to see you." John and Charles gasped in surprise as their friend began to shift and change while they watched. Jack was still there. He hadn't moved, but there was less of him. It was as if the winds of childhood had swirled around him and drawn off some of his substance. His face was still Jack's face, but the north wind took away the leanness and sharp angles, leaving new, softer geometries in its wake. His body was still Jack's body, but the south wind had taken length and breadth. His hands were still Jack's hands, but the east wind made them smaller and more eager, as they once had been. His voice was still Jack's voice, but the west wind took his words and transformed them into memories, and when he spoke, John and Charles felt a shiver pass through them, and felt younger themselves for having heard him.
Ollie, Ollie, oxen free!
Part 5. The King of Tears and the Queen of Sorrows. Chapter 17. The Tunesmiths. The old man's face was ashen. His captor had not returned to the cave, nor had the children who were dressed in the animal skins. He hadn't been tortured or beaten, again anyway, but nevertheless, he was dying. To live, a man must have food, water, air, and shelter. Everyone knew that. But not everyone knew, or if they knew, believed, that it was also necessary to have spirit. One's spirit can be gone for a time, to no ill effect. And it was possible for a man to reject his own spirit, although the ties are never completely broken. But if a spirit leaves of its own accord, then the man it belongs to is weakened, and the old man's spirit had already been gone for too long. "It's no use," the woman in the mirror said. "No one is coming."
"Have faith, my dear," the old man pleaded. "It isn't over till it's over."
The woman in the mirror rolled her eyes. "Child's logic, Peter."
"That's the best kind," he replied weakly. "It allows you to believe what you need to believe, despite all evidence to the contrary. Children do that all the time, and it works more often than you'd think."
"Not often enough, or else you wouldn't be here," he chuckled.
"Thus speaks the cynicism of adulthood, and you wonder why I gave it all up?"
"Oh, yes," she said, mocking. "That explains your grey hair."
"No," the old man replied. "I just finally found my balance. I have the advantages of being a long beard, but I didn't have to give up my child's point of view. That's what allows me to have hope."
The reflection in the mirror scoffed. "Your child's logic sounds a lot like faith to me." At that he smiled.
"Sure. What's the difference?"
"A belief in things not seen makes no sense, Peter."
"And yet," he replied, "a man with no shadow and a woman who exists only as a reflection in a mirror are being held captive by a creature who exists mostly as a disembodied voice. I wouldn't have believed in any of that either, but it's happened."
"If you'd behaved more like an adult, instead of living as a child, perhaps it wouldn't have, Peter. If you'd acted more like a father..."
"That's the only father I knew," said the old man, indicating the head in the back of the cave. "And while his example was imperfect, he was here when I needed him to be, and he gave me the knowledge I needed to survive, and he never left me alone, my dear. Can you say the same about your own children?"
But there was no reply. The mirror had already gone dark, and the cave lapsed into silence once more. The only problem, John surmised, with depending on the judgment of a child to decide a course of action that would determine the fate of two worlds, was that children, as a general rule, didn't care about the fate of the world. They cared about running as fast as they could run. They cared about climbing apple trees. They cared about telling terrible jokes and laughing anyway. They cared about being children, which was as it should be, except when, as John kept trying to point out, the fate of two worlds actually did depend on the judgment of a child. All of which he would have explained to Jack if he could just manage to talk the professor-turned-boy down from Johnny Appletree.
"You are a teacher, aren't you, John?"
said Charles.
"Don't you have experience talking to children?"
"I teach college, not finishing school," said John. "Anyway, we've both got children, haven't we? This shouldn't be quite so hard." Daedalus laughed.
"I never said it would be easy."
John turned to Avon.
"You have a son. Can't you get Jack to focus for 5 minutes so we can sort this out?"
"It's been some time since I could talk to my son as a mother talks to a child," said Avon.
"Why is that?" asked John.
"It happened very early on," Avon explained. "My boy decided he was a man who would one day be king, and therefore should do away with foolishness like a mother's coddling. He was 5, I believe. He wouldn't let me kiss him any more either. He didn't think it was appropriate to display affection in front of his people. Of course, his people usually just consisted of his playmates at Paralon, his tutors, and Tumala, but he'd made his point."
Jack dropped out of the tree and landed clumsily next to Charles, who jumped in surprise.
"This will take some getting used to," said Charles.
"Why?"
asked Jack.
I'm still your Jack. Jacksy, Jack-Jack. I'm still myself. I can still think and reason and remember. Dear God, how I can remember!
John grinned wryly. His friend had the energy of a 10-year-old, that was certain. Less certain was whether that viewpoint, both new and familiar at once, could give them the knowledge they sought.
"Tell us, Jax," said Daedalus, "if you were Hugh and William, and you had been left here in the underneath by your parents, what would you do?"
Jack pondered the question for a moment.
"I think I would build a tree fort."
He leaned over to Avon and whispered behind his hand.
"There are Indians about, you know."
"After the tree fort," prompted Daedalus.
"I'd look for food and potable water," said Jack.
"An adult's answer," said John.
"Then I'd probably have a pee," finished Jack.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," said Charles.
"Then what?"
asked Daedalus.
"I'd have a good think," said Jack, "and I'd probably wonder why it is that adults make children do things they don't want to do."
"Maybe it's because adults know what's best for them," Charles suggested.
"That's good for the boilerplate," said Jack, "but too often adults do whatever they want to do, regardless of what the children want or need, and the adults never pay attention anyway, so why bother?"
Avon scowled at this but remained quiet. John and Charles looked at each other, unsure of what to ask next. Jack pretended to put an apple seed in his mouth, much to Daedalus's dismay, then, grinning, dropped it.
"What are you all so worried about?" said young Jack. "We should play a game. Do you know any games? I bet you do."
"Jack, really?"
Charles said, exasperated.
"There are very important matters to discuss."
"I thought so too," said Jack. "But I now realize I was wrong. There's nothing as important as having fun."
"There are many more things more important than having fun," retorted John. "We have to rescue the missing children. We have to find out what's become of the dragon ships. There are many, many things that need to be put right."
"Well,"
said Jack, who had climbed back into Johnny Appletree and was hanging from his knees upside down,
"isn't that what adults are supposed to do?"
"He has a good point," Bert put in mildly. "Are you starting to see the pattern?"
"Adults don't pay attention to what children say," John said, crestfallen, "and here we are underscoring the point."
"Jack, I say, Jack,"
Charles began, walking around the tree,
"will you come down from there so we can discuss this properly?"
Jack stuck his fingers in his ears.
"La la 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 la,"
he cried.
"I can't hear you! I can't hear you!"
Charles scratched his head.
"We are never going to get through to him if he can't even hear what we're saying."
John snapped his fingers.
"That's it, Charles! That's the ticket!"
The caretaker Principia turned to Daedalus.
"When Laura Glue came to us in Oxford, she told us Peter had sealed her ears with beeswax. Why would he have done that?"
"It's an old trick of Peter's," Daedalus said, "that goes back to the origins of Haven itself. It's to prevent..."
He paused and put his hand to his chin, thinking.
"It's to prevent one from being swayed by the persuasion of the panpipes," Daedalus said finally. "But why would Peter have put beeswax in his own granddaughter's ears? She wasn't at risk from him."
"What do you mean by persuasion?" asked John. Daedalus folded his hands behind his back and bowed his head.
"It is something inexorably intertwined with the history of the Argo, the lost boys, and finally with Peter himself," he said. "The pipes of Pan have always had the ability to influence, to persuade, and to enchant. But of all who have heard its charms, the only ones who cannot resist are the children." "It began with the old gods," Daedalus continued. "The Romantics civilized the stories and retroactively remodeled our images of what they were meant to symbolize. They were not toga-draped Caesars and Cleopatras. They were raw, primal. And the one who most embodied that, who arose from Mother Earth herself, wrapped in root and loam, and who never truly scraped off the soil of his birth, was Pan."
His exploits and mischief are literally the stuff of legends, but the most famous story of Pan involves the origin of his trademark panpipes, said Daedalus. There was a beautiful nymph named Syrinx, who was beloved by all the other dwellers in the wood, but she scorned them all. She believed they were lesser creatures than she, and as such were beneath her notice. One day, as she was returning from the hunt, Pan saw her through the trees of his wildwood, and he became enamored of her. She rejected his advances and ran away. He shouted words praising her grace and beauty, but she didn't stop to hear his compliments and quickened her pace. He followed, continuing to pursue her until she came to the bank of a river. There he overtook her, and she had only enough time to call out to her kin, the water nymphs, for help. Just as Pan laid his hands upon her, the nymphs turned her into river reeds, which infuriated the god. He stormed to and fro across the banks of the river, shouting his fury, when a slight, plaintive melody caught his attention. It was the reeds that had once been Syrinx. When the air blew through them, it produced music, and the sound was very pleasing to him. So the god took some of the reeds to make an instrument that he called a syrinx, the panpipes, in honor of the nymph he had pursued and lost. But Pan was not yet finished with the nymphs. One of those who had protected Syrinx was a graceful dancer who had a sweet, trilling voice. Her name was Echo.
"Like the well," said Charles.
"Not like the well," corrected Daedalus. "Echo is the well, or at least she is the water within." Like her cousin, Echo scorned the love of any man. This angered Pan even more, to have been turned away twice by those who were not respectful of his birthright as a god. In revenge, he instructed his followers to kill her. Echo was torn to pieces and spread all over the earth, and all that was left was her voice. As punishment for what he had done, the gods, led by the goddess of the earth, Gaia, remade the nymph as an elemental and allowed her to exist as a pool of living waters. They also granted Echo the ability to reflect back the words spoken to her and to give the speaker his heart's desire. The gods then took from Pan the one object he treasured most, the pipes he had made from the nymph Syrinx, and they gave them to a mortal who had been called on a great quest by the hero Jason. They gave the pipes to Orpheus.
"How did the pipes make their way from Orpheus to Peter?" Bert asked.
"That implies that there are more connections to the time of Jason's crusade than just the name of the islands."
"Correct," said Daedalus. "Under Orpheus, the Pan became a title in and of itself, a designation of office of a sort. Orpheus was the first Pan to use the panpipes, and although he was skilled with the lyre, it was possession of a divine instrument that time and again saved the Argonauts. After Jason's betrayal of Medea, the Argonauts scattered to the corners of the earth. Heracles was already gone, as was Theseus. Argos, the builder of the ship, was dead, and the others went on to lead their lives free of Jason's corrupted legacy. But of them all, only Orpheus maintained a relationship with Medea. He was a kind of uncle to her sons, and secretly helped her when she told him of her plan to hide them away from their father. What he didn't realize was that she intended to abandon them here. She never left them wholly ungoverned. She built a home for herself on a nearby island, but she seldom visited them, for fear that Jason might discover they still lived.
"What a wench," said Charles.
"More like a witch," said John.
"Well spoken, John," said Bert.
"She was a witch," Daedalus agreed, "in action as well as name. She enchanted the dragons that had guarded the Golden Fleece, and defeated the bronze giant Talos when he attacked the Argo. If she had not been a witch, the Argonauts
would have perished many times over. She knew this, and it was the root of her hatred for Jason's betrayal.
"Those poor boys," said Avon, who had been quietly absorbing all that was said. "To revenge herself against their father, she condemned them to a fate worse than death, a lifetime of loneliness."
"That's what Orpheus thought too," said Daedalus. "He pleaded with Medea to take them elsewhere, but she would not be swayed, and she was far too powerful for him to go against her will. And so Orpheus chose a different route. He began seeking out playmates for the boys who could be brought here to the underneath."
It slowly dawned on John where the inventor was going with his story. "He used the panpipes, didn't he?"
"Yes," said Daedalus. "He went out into the world, to your world, and lured away children to become the playmates of Jason's sons, to become lost boys themselves. This is the origin of the legends of children being lured from their beds in the middle of the night by soft strains of music that no adult seemed to hear. It wasn't that they couldn't hear it, but it was not meant for them, and so the children simply disappeared, and no one knew to where."
"Orpheus concealed himself well," Bert huffed. "I know a great deal about the myths and legends of the world, and I've never before heard his name connected with the disappearing children."
"Not as such," said Daedalus. "But that was not the name by which the children knew him either. They had their own name for him, and fashioned their own mythology. And in the whispers under the covers, and in the dark corners of the room, the children knew that if you heard music in the night, it meant that the King of Crickets was coming for you."
Bert paled, then sat heavily on the grass.
"The King of Crickets?"
he said, his voice trembling.
He's a Pan?"
"Originally he was Orpheus," Daedalus explained. "But after him, others assumed the office of the Pan, and the mythology about the King of Crickets followed them, too. Ulysses had two sons with the enchantress Circe, and one of them became the Pan for a time before leaving the underneath. A few poets from your world and at least one painter have held the office, and there came a time when the lost boys took it on themselves to find their own playmates, and thereafter the Pan was not an adult, but a child."
"And because of Echo's well, he never needed to age,"
Charles concluded.
"Ideal."
"So children were enchanted and brought against their will," said John. "I like that not at all." "Peter didn't believe in it," said Avon. "He believed that children should choose to come here if they wished, and not be forced to become lost. Orpheus trained him to use the pipes, as he had trained Peter's predecessor, Puck. But Peter never used the pipes as the others had. He would find children and whisper to them in the night, and if they so chose, he would bring them here, but never against their will. Having seen the power of the panpipes, others among the lost boys, particularly Hugh and William, became uncomfortable with the idea that they could be compelled against their will to do anything, and so Peter came up with the idea of putting beeswax in their ears as a means of protection against the music. Because they were children, he even made a game of it." Avon lowered her head and swore softly as memories began to flood back to her. John and Charles exchanged knowing glances with Bert, and almost involuntarily they all looked at Jack, who was running gleefully through the apple orchard with the other children.
"It's the first thing they learn here," said Daedalus. "The children imagine that the King of Crickets is coming for them, and they all pack beeswax in their ears and hide among the trees and the rocks. Peter would designate a safe base, and one by one the children would make their way home. The first one there would then take the wax from his ears and shout at the top of his lungs,
'Ollie, Ollie, oxen free,'" John and Avon said together. On hearing the words, all the children immediately stopped their games and crowed into the air.
"Hey!" Jack called out to John. "You win! Good show, John!"
"Peter saw being the Pan as a noble calling that would allow him to protect children," Daedalus said, "so that what had happened to Hugh and William
would not happen to other children.
That's quite an undertaking for a child, Bert pointed out, and a very mature point of view.
It is, Daedalus agreed. But then, Peter is an exceptional being. In all these centuries, he was the first to come here of his own free will, and the only child ever to discover the underneath of his own accord.
I didn't know that, said Avon, but I'm not surprised. Daedalus grinned with the memory.
It was he whom I first made wings for, to help him fly, he said with no small pride. His lame leg, remember? He had the spirit for it, and had done such a great thing in coming here, that I felt compelled to help him move as freely as the other children.
And after that, you just kept making wings for the lost boys, said Bert.
Well, said Daedalus, you know how children are. Once they saw what one of them had, they all wanted them.
Hey, said Jack, running up to the companions. Do I get to have a pair of wings too? Daedalus knelt down to look him in the eye.
That depends, the inventor said. Are you lost?
In answer, Jack merely laughed and ran back to the other children. John folded his arms and turned to Charles. I think someone has the panpipes, he said. That explains everything that's happened. Peter's caution with Laura Glue, the warning in Bacon's history, and especially the missing children. If someone were using the panpipes against the children, they'd be unable to resist, and none of the adults would even know it was happening until it was too late.
Peter was the last to have them, and the only one now living who knew how to use them, said Daedalus. I can only assume he was taken when the children were, because we never found him, and he would not have gone willingly.
Could he have been entranced as well? Asked Charles. Since the pipes affect children.
Not all children, put in Charles.
Not if they had beeswax in their ears.
John snapped his fingers. That's why the King of Crickets needed the clockwork men, to catch the children who couldn't be compelled to follow the piping.
The children who couldn't be compelled, Bert said darkly. And their leader.
Peter hasn't been a child in years,
Daedalus said, looking askance at Avon.
He decided, finally, that it was time to grow up, and he's never regretted that choice. He adores his daughter, called Alice Bluebonnet, and even more so, her daughter, Laura Glue.
Then he was taken by force, stated Avon, and his last act was to send Laura Glue for help.
Then we've got to help him, said John, pounding a fist into his hand. We must, and we have to start by finding the tunesmith who's causing the trouble.
What are you thinking, John? Said Bert.
I think if he can live for thousands of years, John replied, motioning to Daedalus, and also Hugh and William, then others from that time may have survived as well. And we know of one, trained to use the pipes, who had no issue with compelling children against their will.
Orpheus. I think our adversary is Orpheus.
Chapter 18. Shadows of History. At Daedalus's suggestion, the companions and the lost boys left the orchard and returned to the more secure confines of Haven proper. The crenellated towers extended all around the orchard and gardens as well, but all of them felt an easing of tension at the idea of being within more closely built walls. Jack had continued to evince further changes as a result of his transformation. It was as if he had forgotten being an adult, except when a point in the conversation required some arcane bit of knowledge that only he possessed. Then he rattled off details that made him seem exactly what he was, an Oxford professor in a 10-year-old boy's body. On the walk up the path, they again passed by Echo's Well, where Daedalus asked John and Charles if they wouldn't like to reconsider, now that they'd seen that no harm had come to Jack. Thank you, no, said John. I think one of us having the perspective of a child is enough.
But as you can clearly see, Daedalus persisted, he's lost none of his ability to reason and none of his education. It's simply being filtered through a more youthful point of view.
Sorry, John said again, exchanging a puzzled glance with a slightly concerned Bert. I think I can keep my focus better as a
Longbeard.
Same here,
Charles answered when the inventor posed the question to him.
I might like to return sometime, once the crisis has passed, and give it a go. But not this time around, I'm afraid.
As you wish,
Daedalus said, with the faintest of tension in his jaw.
I only thought it might help. There are still many questions to be answered.
Agreed, said John. Foremost among them is this. Why weren't all the children taken? Daedalus stopped and turned to him.
What do you mean?
John indicated the children skipping around them in odd, loopy circles. Pelvis Parsley, Maggie Tree and Leaf, Fred the Goat, all the children here. Why weren't they taken with the others?
Perhaps they had beeswax in their ears, like Laura Glue,
Charles suggested.
No, said Bert. She told us the clockwork men came for them, remember? The beeswax would have protected them from the panpipes, but not from clockworks.
Oh,
said Charles, crestfallen. Is there anything special about the children who were left here? John asked Daedalus.
In the archipelago, none were left. They were all taken. So for these children to have been left behind, there had to be something setting them apart.
Daedalus considered that for a moment.
I cannot say. Perhaps the enemy had what they came for, Peter.
That doesn't fit, argued Avon. It isn't consistent with everything else we've seen.
I agree, John said. We...
He stopped and turned around.
Charles,
John asked,
what is it?
The lanky editor had stopped walking and was standing about 20 feet back on the path. He was staring at the playing children with an odd look on his face.
Charles, said Bert, what's wrong?
Oh, I don't think anything's wrong, said Charles,
not taking his eyes from the children.
But has anyone noticed,
he continued in a trembling voice,
that Jack is sporting an extra shadow?
The others stared. Charles was right. When Jack darted around a large stone bench, playing Monster and the Frogs with the other children, his shadow followed as a shadow should, and a second shadow followed an instant later. John craned his head around to look for another light source.
There's probably a very simple explanation, Charles, he said with the beginnings of a smile. In our last outing together, Jack was the one who gave up his shadow. I hardly think he'd overcompensate by adding a new one this time.
It's not a second light casting it, noted Bert, or else all the children would have two shadows.
He was right. The other lost boys were playing in the same area, but only Jack had twin shadows. Avon summoned him over, and he ran to the companions, panting.
That was quick, said Charles.
I was tagged out anyway, said Jack. Do you want to play with me, Poppy?
At the mention of her old Netherland name, Avon blushed.
No, thank you, Jack. When did you get the extra shadow?
Jack looked at her and blinked, then looked behind him, turning around like a dog, trying to catch its tail.
Oh, that,
he said, as if she'd asked him why he had two ears or a nose.
It began to follow me after I spoke into the well.
What do you think it wants? Asked John.
Easy peasy, said Jack.
It wants me to follow it.
Follow it?
Daedalus said, surprised.
Why didn't you mention it sooner, Jack?
Because,
Jack said, rolling his eyes in exasperation,
I wasn't out yet.
The companions retired back to Daedalus's workshop, bringing Jack with them. Of all the lost boys, only Laura Glue chose to come as well, rather than go to sleep.
I don't need to sleep too often, except after long flights,
she said.
And my grandfather always said, he can sleep when he's dead. I'm not sure what that means, but if it's all the same, I'd rather stay with you.
Of course, dear girl,
Charles said, taking her hand.
We wouldn't feel safe without our good luck charm.
Jack's extra shadow continued to dart about at odd moments, as if it wasn't quite comfortable being attached to someone with a shadow already in residence. It didn't react when Bert or John tried to touch it, but it swiveled around completely when Daedalus tried to touch it as well.
Hmm,
the inventor sniffed.
I don't know if I should be insulted or not that I repulse a shadow.
Where does it want you to go? John asked when they'd gotten settled into the chairs at the workshop.
West, said Jack. I'm pretty sure it's west. It's very curious, he added, stroking his arms in wonder. It's a bit like the chill you might get when a ghost enters a room, except it isn't cold. It's warm, very warm.
What do you think?
Bert asked Daedalus, who had busied himself checking his cauldrons.
Is it a good omen or bad?
I don't think it's an omen at all, the inventor replied. I think it's another message, and it's one that should not be ignored. To sever one's shadow is not a task for the faint of heart. If it's gone too long from the body, one could weaken, even die. So for someone to send it here, now, to Jack, they must want to guide you somewhere very, very badly.
What lies west of Haven? John asked. Daedalus turned, face lit by the vapours from his cauldron fires.
The rest of the underneath. The path of Ulysses, and Dante, and Jason. And maybe, just maybe, the answers you are seeking, Caveo Principia.
The inventor handed John the book he'd read from earlier, there in the workshop.
This is a history, written by one of your predecessors, said Daedalus. One of the oldest. It was written by Homer's son-in-law, the poet Stasinus, thousands of years ago, and it contains what you will need to know about traversing the districts of the underneath. The primary name of these lands is Artano, which refers to everything found here. But each of the individual islands has its own obstacles and oppositions to overcome. The tidal forces here can be immense, as you saw crossing from Croatoan Island, Daedalus went on. The inhabited outer lands of the first district are not themselves a true archipelago of islands, but the high ground that exists during the tide. When it's out, we can go anywhere we like, but when it comes in, as you've seen, it becomes impassable.
Impossible? Asked John.
Impassable, repeated Daedalus. Others who have travelled here saw the tides as a river. Some called it the Styx, others the River Lethe. Names have come and gone, but the tides remain.
We say Atlas is shrugging, said Laura Glue.
I wouldn't blame him a bit if he did, Charles said. At any rate, Daedalus continued, the tides here do not shift with the moon, as they do in your world. They move by the calendar each day, so when morning comes, they will go out again.
And Burton and the Croatoans will be able to cross, said Bert. Understood. We must leave before then.
Croatoan Island and the land Haven stands upon comprise the first district, said Daedalus. The second consists of the Isle of Centrum Terrae, which is a kingdom of lakes and black forests. It has been the province of witches and sorceresses, now abandoned, but great beasts still roam there. Be cautious, and heed the history's warnings. Also in the second district is the pirate's island of Hulumulu, said Daedalus. It must be traversed to reach the next district, but skirt the perimeter, and avoid meeting any of the inhabitants if you can. In the third district, you will find but a single isle, Lixus, the island of automatons. If you move through it quickly, there should be nothing to fear on Lixus.
At this, John and Charles exchanged curious glances, both of them thinking the same thing. Automatons? As in clockwork men? Charles began to say something, but was silenced by a slight shake of John's head. Something was not quite right here. John just couldn't yet put his finger on what it was.
The fourth district, Daedalus continued, is also comprised of a single land, Fallon, the Great Pit. In truth, it is less an island than a great rending in the earth, where ores are mined to provide the raw materials for the inhabitants of Lixus. You must go straight through the center, but be wary, for the way is filled with more perils than those physical. The fifth district contains the seventh and eighth lands. First
Is Aea?
Circe's island, stated Charles, from the Odyssey.
The same, Daedalus said with a hint of surprise. If you know that much, you should already know of the dangers you may face there. Just apart from Aea are the Wandering Isles, which are the only other islands past the second district that are fully inhabited. The original settlers were Greek refugees, but centuries later a company of travellers seeking refuge from the Black Plague also came there during your Middle Ages. They greet wanderers as fellow travellers, and those with the ability to tell stories are accorded great benefits, much as if they were visiting royalty.
So, John concluded, if we can get through witches, pirates, mechanical men, the Great Pit, and Circe, we'll end up at a place where we will be honored for our storytelling. Grand, that.
Look at it this way, said Bert. After all that, we'll have no shortage of tales to tell.
You've told us there were 8 lands, said Charles, but there was another indicated on our map of Artano. What of the 9th land?
Daedalus closed the book and shook his head.
I don't think you'll be going that far. What you search for is most likely found within the closer lands. To go farther is not something many before you have done, and I would not advise it now.
I suppose you can make that decision later on, said Charles, if circumstances warrant.
I won't be going with you, Daedalus said, with a curious halting in his voice. At present, I cannot leave my experiments.
Ha! Avon snorted. That's a crock. Most of the children of Haven are missing too, or hadn't you noticed?
I have other responsibilities which require that I stay here on Haven, said Daedalus. I am truly sorry.
Bert frowned, and Avon drew in a sharp breath, but John and Charles merely thanked the inventor for the book and the wise counsel. Daedalus and Laura Glue went to a large storeroom and assembled some of the supplies the companions would need for the journey, while Jack remained with the others.
I'm not sure I trust him entirely, John murmured. Something's afoot.
Nonsense, Avon said. He's Daedalus. He's been a friend and protector to the Lost Boys for as long as I can remember. I trust him completely.
I'm not certain either, daughter, said Bert.
Why?
Because, Jack chimed in, he's a Longbeard.
So are we,
Charles said, gesturing at the others.
Do you trust us?
That's different, said Jack. You're only adults on the outside, but on the inside, you're just like me.
Okay,
Laura Glue exclaimed as she and Daedalus returned to the workshop, laden with bundles.
We're ready to go save the world.
It was decided that they wouldn't wake the other children, but would let them slumber as the companions left. John made the suggestion in part to hasten their departure, but also because he realized that leaving would be more difficult for Avon if she had to say goodbye to all her friends. There had been some discussion as to whether Jack and Laura Glue should remain behind in the safer confines of Haven, but Laura Glue insisted that she could be an invaluable guide since she had been born in the Underneath. And Jack refused to stay on more practical grounds. The missing Lost Boys had been taken from Haven to begin with, and even Peter Pan couldn't protect them. The safest place for him to be was with the others whom Peter was depending on to save them all. Daedalus hugged Avon and Laura Glue, and walked with the group of travellers to the westernmost gate of Haven. He opened the gate, but did not step through. "Go ahead," John said to the others. I want to speak with Daedalus a moment. When the rest of the companions were safely out of earshot, Daedalus folded his hands behind his back and looked questioningly at John.
Yes, Caveo Principia?
You can't leave, can you? John said in a low voice. Daedalus looked at him as if to say something defiant, then deflated slightly and shook his head, looking down at the edges of the stonework that marked the limits of Haven's foundation. You didn't take your father's name, did you? John continued. You are Daedalus. The inventor didn't answer right away, but instead looked out across Haven and sighed deeply.
After Icarus's death, Iapix wouldn't speak to me,
he said at last. He believed it was my arrogance that had caused the death of his brother, and I cannot